You make this pizza?
Who make this pizza?
We're asking you. This your store logo, sir?
That's in my box.
This pie was found at a crime scene.
My pizza never hurt nobody.
Come again, sir?
You don't find any bacteria in here.
Some kids broke into Verdun Day High School, broke things. They left us there.
Now, you tell me their names, I go put my foot up their ass.
I got it, Pop. It's a custom job.
How's that, sir?
Double meatball, pepperoni, sausage, peppers, onions, extra mozzarella.
This pie fit a pattern?
Come again, officer?
Any customers order this combo on a regular basis?
Only one I know.
Who's that?
I'd rather not say.
Help me right now. I find it, these bastards.
Pop, go in the back. Make meatballs. Go ahead.
Sir.
Yes, officer?
Word to the wise.
What's that?
Technically, you're an accessory after the fact.
Ah, phenomenal.
What happened?
They paid us got your own, by the word.
Buongiorno, everyone. Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. Back on the horse for good. I'm sorry for the delay, but if you've been following the blog at mylifeasafoodie.com, you'll see that we've actually been busy, just not with the podcast. Blog posts, dude food, everything but the show. But the show will be back on track now. We're going to do two more episodes in December, maybe more. For those of you who are still listening, I want to thank you for hanging in there. The feedback on dude food has been absolutely amazing, and I thank everybody for their support and for having a sense of humor about it. All right, it did take a big bite out of the show, so I apologize for that, but we've got really big things on the horizon for My Life as a Foodie, including some changes in 2011 that will be very positive. We're focusing today on all things Italian, and not just food, okay? It's funny, because when some people ask me what my background is, and this goes for anybody, if you're German or Irish or whatever, I'll tell them the story of my grandparents coming from Sicily to Ellis Island in the 1910s, and they'll say, oh, you're Italian. And for years, what followed was either, I love Italian food, or was your family in the mafia? And I never had an answer for that, because when I asked my mother, she wouldn't tell me anything. And she'd say stuff like, well, we don't talk about those things because it's dangerous to talk about that. It took me years to realize that, yes, there were some mafia dealings in my family, dating back to her uncle and the things that he had done for one Al Capone. All right. And then that got back to where, you know, you didn't really tell anybody anything because families held grudges for years. And if you were involved in the mafia, which my family was not, but if you were involved in the mafia, you were sworn to uphold an oath, an omerta. The omerta is what they call it. It's an oath of silence. So if anybody found out that you spoke of anything outside of their thing, your family could be in danger. So even up to the mid-80s, I had a hard time getting information out of my mother. I suspected there was something, but she would never tell me. So she eventually told me everything because of a situation that basically outed the family when my uncle died. Katrina turns to me at this funeral, and she says, don't tell me there aren't connected people in your family. Look at those people over there. And I told her I didn't know a lot, but we don't talk about that stuff. My mom just wouldn't share it, but she eventually shared some stories with me, and I didn't tell anybody until I was forced to speak to my mom late in her life and get the whole story. But no one in my family was in the mafia, okay? They did some favors for connected people, and they in turn had to return the favors. So I don't have any romantic stories to tell you about gunfights or hits or anything like that. But it is sad how some people lived back then, and it's definitely sad how they died. Now, I'm not easily offended, right? So when I get these questions, it's no big deal. But this happens with cultures. You tell someone you're German, and someone might ask you, really, were any of your family in, like, you know, the Nazi, you know, regime? Or if you're Irish, or were you part of the IRA? Was your family part of the IRA? I mean, these are offensive questions. But I never took offense to it, because the Italian-American culture was that people automatically assumed that in some way, shape, or form, your family at some point had something to do with the mafia, especially if you came from Sicily, where the mafia kind of started. There are a lot of Italian-Americans who take offense to these questions. And I think it all started with The Godfather, because The Godfather made the biggest impact. And after it aired, people started automatically assuming that if you were Italian, there was a good chance your family was in the mafia. So they'd get pissed off. And they got pissed off at the makers of The Godfather and anybody who glamorized the mob. And it got so bad that Francis Ford Coppola had to give a disclaimer when The Godfather aired for the first time on national television.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Francis Ford Coppola, and I directed The Godfather. We're at work now in the final stages, the finishing touches of Godfather Part 2, working in the same room in the same way that we did almost 3 years ago when we finished the film that you're just about to see. The story is fiction, the work of its author Mario Puzo, but it was suggested by fact and by the lives of a few violent men, so the film is violent, it had to be. I tried to avoid any stereotypes in the film, so that the mannerisms and home life and the feeling of the people are as authentic as I could remember from my own upbringing in an Italian-American home, even though my family, as are the majority of Italian-Americans, in quite a different business. I hope no one will let this story or these characters in any way reflect on the whole of the Italian people. I think that would be unfair.
So, to celebrate that, during the show today, we're going to play a fun game. We're going to celebrate this so-called slap in the face to Italian-Americans and Italians from New Jersey. Because if The Sopranos was a slap in the face to Sicilians in Jersey, what the hell would you call Jersey Shore? Because quite frankly, I think that's a bigger slap in the face. That does not really kind of tell you what Italians are like and or what Italians in Jersey are like, because it's not like that at all. But you'd think so because that's what you see on television. I'm going to pepper the show with audio from Italian mob movies, and I'm going to try to pull segments where they're talking about food in some way, whether they're cooking, eating, or just talking about food. Not all of them, because not every movie has food in it, but they all should. We'll see how many of these movies you can guess correctly. There's no prizes, there's no contests, it's just for fun, and I thought it would be kind of a cool thing. Here's the first clip.
Rito! Rito, you son of a bitch! You look great! Frank Pentangelia!
I thought you was never coming out west, you big bum. I gotta check on my boys, huh?
Hey, Fredo, hey, what's with the food around here?
What's the matter?
Kid comes up to me in a white jacket, gives me a Ritz cracker and a chopped liver, he says, canapes. I said, canapes my ass, that's a Ritz cracker and chopped liver. He goes, hey, what? Bring out the peppers and zucchinis. You might have room over
here. Oh, seeing you reminds me of New York, the old days, huh?
Hey, Fredo.
Seems weird calling it a clip, too, right? Because everyone's getting clipped. Funny thing is, I didn't know this until we went into a private dinner hosted by these two Italian chefs, that if you're Sicilian, there are Italians who feel like you're second class, that you're not Italian. The Napolitans, the people from Naples, they think that they're better than you if you're Sicilian. They're, you know, the upper-class Italians. And they'll make no secret that if you're Sicilian, you're scum. Your family is scum. You're second class. I learned this the hard way. Didn't see it coming because my mother never told me this. Of all the lessons she taught me, she might have missed this one. We were at this dinner. One of the chefs, he learned that... I was Sicilian. There was a guy and a girl. She's showing me the Italian way of eating pasta. You gently roll it on your fork in small bites. Then she goes, here, I'll show you the Sicilian way, where she wound it the size of a baseball and shoved it in my mouth. Now, I'd have preferred if she just kicked me in the nuts. All right? That was offensive to me. She didn't have to do that. But she didn't stop there. She stopped short of telling me that my family were more than likely peasants and servants. And you know what? They were. She was right. But that doesn't mean that they were bad people, but she said it like they were. My grandparents were very poor in Sicily. They came to America poor and lived most of their lives poor. My family's always been poor. You know, we didn't have a lot of money. We never really have. But we had love, and that was all that mattered. And I think that's what matters in most Italian households. And for some reason, my mother glamorized The Godfather because of the family. Well, Michael Corleone killed his family. He ruined his family. How do you glamorize that? There's nothing glamorous about it. So, you know, we had love. That was all that mattered to us until my brother bought a Volvo. Then all of a sudden, money mattered to everybody. But this Italian whore that night, who was taking my money for cooking me some of the shittiest Italian food I've ever tasted in my life and insisted on a tip at the end of the night to boot. This guinea bitch insulted my family to my face and insulted Sicilians in front of everybody. And I wasn't making this up in my head. Katrina noticed it, and she was offended. And she's Irish. I won't forget that. I won't forget it every time I visit an Italian deli that has these immigrants working in there who act like they're better than any Sicilian. My mother would walk into these delis, she'd order in Italian, because my mother, she loved being Italian. She celebrated it. Every day she celebrated it. And whenever she got the opportunity to speak Italian to somebody who could understand it, she'd do it. So these Napolitans would hear my mother speaking in her obviously Sicilian dialect, and they'd make snide derogatory comments to her. Clearly it hurt her feelings. She'd come back, she'd be all dejected. And I felt bad. You know, you don't want to treat people like that. You treat people like that, I'll think even less of you than you think of my grandparents. Go fuck yourself. Then make me a sandwich. All right, enough of the hate. Let's have a beer. I happen to think, and I'm not alone here, because I'm Sicilian, mind you, because there's a distinction. I think Italian beer is so unimpressive that people sometimes forget that Italy even makes beer. The two that you can find easily in the U.S., Peroni and Birra Moretti, overall, not something I can tell you I even remember having. I mean, I've had it. I know I've had it. But I can't tell you anything about it other than it tasted like most bottled beers from Czech Republic or China or Germany or whatever. I mean, all these beers have the same life. They're pilsners or lagers. They're made in green bottles. They bottle it. They get thrown in a wooden crate. They sit on a dock for a few days. They make it onto a boat, 2-month boat ride, get on another dock, in a warehouse somewhere for months, and then finally they make it to the shelf in the beer store where it sits and it skunks for about 3 months before you finally buy it and you drink it. You tell me that that sounds like a beer that's going to taste good. Maybe Peroni or Birra Moretti from the source is fantastic, but after the horrible journey out here, it's like you're drinking the beer equivalent of child abuse. So imagine this. I buy this beer, and I'm totally shocked. I'm doing research for Guinea Month, as I've been calling November the Guinea Trilogy, because I focus on all things Italian. I found La Rosa. It's a Doppelbock made by Birra Moretti. It's a deep, malty, red, sweet lager. If you told me this was made by an Italian brewer and I didn't know it, I'd tell you you were full of crap. It's 7.2% alcohol. It's a Doppelbock, which is a double Bock beer. It's a German style. For those of you who don't know the style very well, I got to tell you something. This is a very, very drinkable beer. I don't know what malts they use in the beer, but it's either crystal malt or caramel malt of some kind. It's very sweet, very dense. It's got some nutty flavors in there. And I read somewhere, I don't remember where I read it, they brew this beer with noble hops, which are like the premier German varieties of hops. And I can't get much of hoppiness out of the beer, which is great because I'm really not into hops all that much anymore. I'm not into like the whole hop frenzy thing. And a lot of people are. Rick Sellers, Odonata Brewing and Pacific Brew News, he loves that stuff. I prefer sweet malt bombs any day. Now, is it a great beer? No. Drinkable? Definitely. And it's something I could totally see pairing with any kind of an Italian dish. In fact, here's the deal. I've got a recipe. I'm going to share it with you. But I'll share it with you right after we hear another Italian mob movie clip. Because that's what Italians are known for. Stealing and killing people. Oh, and great food.
Is it true that the Chinese invented spaghetti?
Now think about it. Why would people who eat with sticks invent something that you need a fork to eat?
Okay, I want to share a really killer Italian dish with you guys. I haven't found it on too many menus when I'm at an Italian restaurant, but it's so damn good. I wonder if we can't start a new revolution and get it on more menus. Then again, what do I know? You know, maybe it is available and I'm just not seeing it. Again, like I said, I don't eat at too many restaurants. And when we do usually Italian, it's Italian-American type restaurants. So they're like family-run type of places. Not the Olive Garden. I mean, come on. Give me a break, will you? Anyway, the dish is called Salta Bocca. Okay, traditionally, it's made with veal and prosciutto. But I like to make it with chicken. Because the flavor contrast of salty prosciutto over a pretty flavorless chicken breast is a really good compliment. And here's what you need to make Salta Bocca for 4 servings. This will feed 4 people, okay? You need 4 thin veal scallops, pounded thin, or 2 chicken breasts that you slit into halves and you pound those out. This is one time when it's absolutely necessary for you to pound your meat, all right? So grab the mallet and have at that son of a bitch. 8 fresh sage leaves, 4 thin slices of prosciutto that you're going to cut to the same size as the veal or the chicken scallops. You'll need flour for dredging, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 tablespoons of butter, 4 tablespoons of white wine, 4 tablespoons of chicken stock, and 4 tablespoons of Marsala wine. which I love to say because Marsala was my mother's maiden name. The family didn't come from Marsala. My grandparents came from our Agrigento, I think is how you pronounce it, the little town in southern Sicily. But the name always puts a smile on my face because Marsala just sounds Italian. All right. Okay, salt and pepper and then some fresh sage leaves for garnish. The first thing you want to do is take these pieces of meat, all right, on a sheet of plastic wrap or parchment paper and cover it with a second sheet. And then you use a meat mallet or a rolling pin and beat the shit out of that meat until it's twice the original size and really thin. It's important that you cover the meat before you pound it, because if you strike the meat unprotected with the mallet, it could break or tear a hole in it. Now, that's not a huge deal, but it's best just kind of keep it together so, you know, you're not eating meat with holes in it. Okay, lightly season the scallops with salt and pepper, and then lay two fresh sage leaves on each piece of meat, and then lay the prosciutto over the meat to cover the sage, and then fit it to the size of the scallop. Secure the prosciutto to the veal with the toothpicks, or if you want to make it more like a chicken cordon bleu, you can just kind of fold it in half. Just, you know, hold the cheese. Oh, or what the hell, put cheese in it, all right? A little Parmesan or whatever. You'll be making a different dish, but I like when people go off the reservation. So there's no rules here. If you want to do it like that, you can. Anyway, dredge the prosciutto-covered meat with the toothpicks in it in flour on both sides. Knock off the excess flour. Then heat some olive oil and the butter in a large skillet over medium heat, and then fry the scallops on both sides for about 3 to 4 minutes per side until they're golden brown. The meat is pounded thin, okay? So it's not going to take long to cook it. And that's the beauty of this dish. Just don't overcook it. Chicken breast dries out quicker than Paula Deen can eat a plate of brownies, all right? So be careful. Don't overcook it, and you'll be fine. Because I'll tell you what, chicken breast does not have a lot of flavor. Dry it out, it tastes like you're eating paper, okay? It's bad. So that's why I prefer chicken thighs over chicken breast, but a dish like this, you've got to have a breast. So you've cooked the scallops, all right, and these brown bits and stuff in the pan, right? Great. You turn the heat up, and now you add white wine and Marsala wine. You deglaze it, add some chicken stock, get that boiling, and make sure you stir it up really well. Keep stirring. Get that fond off the bottom, anything that's stuck to the bottom. Get it up. Make a nice gravy, okay? Then you boil it till it reduces to about half. That concentrates flavors, burns off the alcohol, and it's fantastic. Now taste it. If you want it to have some salt, you can season it with a little salt. Add that, pour it over the salt and bocca, serve it immediately, and garnish with fresh sage leaves. And remember, pasta course comes first. Don't serve this on the side with pasta. All right, pasta first, then the meat. People in this country eat meat and pasta together. That's not how they do it in Italy and Sicily. They think we're stupid when we do this. And while I'm at it, I should do this for you anyway. Here are some rules that you should follow if you want to pretend like you're Italian. A lot of people say, oh, I wish I was Italian. Okay, first of all, you got to get used to the fact that your family's probably going to stab you in the back. All right? That's how you feel Italian. But there are rules that you have to abide by to live Italian. Here's the deal. Pasta and meat are always separate. Pasta first, then meatballs, or your salt and bocca in this case, or whatever you're having. Don't oversauce your pasta. This is like putting the equal amount of mustard on your hot dog, the equivalent to the actual hot dog. It's a condiment. Think of it like mustard. You wouldn't over-mustard something, would you? Don't oversauce it. Sauce is a condiment. You have to treat it like a condiment. The pasta is the star of the dish. You're eating pasta. You're not eating sauce and pasta. You're eating pasta with sauce. So the key is to buy good pasta so the pasta tastes good. All right, you want really good pasta. If you know how to make your own pasta, then you're just a stud. But if you can, like most of us, buy some fresh or dried, but get good dried pasta. There's good dried pasta, too. Get the good shit. It's cheap. Spend money on the good stuff. You'll be glad you did, really. The other thing is, cappuccino. That's a morning drink. You drink that before 11 a.m. If it's after 11, don't put milk in your coffee. Now, I used to do this wrong. I'd get coffee in the middle of the afternoon, and I put milk in it. That's not the way to do it. If you live in Italian and you want to have coffee in the afternoon, have an espresso. That's the Italian way. Italians like espresso in the afternoon. No milk. Milk's for breakfast. My mother-in-law, she was a pain in the ass about the sauce thing. I'd serve her pasta. She'd be like, does this have any sauce on it? I'm like, yeah, look at that. There's sauce in there. Not enough sauce. So I'd bury her pasta in sauce. It would kill me to do it, but I'd do it because I wanted her to be happy. She'd still say it was light on sauce. I mean, dude, I'm looking at it. It's like,
Yeah, it's light, but it's edible, you know? It's just ingrained in people. And she's not alone. Americans love this. They love pasta swimming in sauce. I blame Chef Boyardee. I mean, that crap, it's like tomato soup with something that resembles ravioli in it.
In prison, dinner was always a big thing. We had a pasta course, and then we had a meat or a fish. Paulie did the prep work. He was doing a year for contempt, and he had this wonderful system for doing the garlic. He used a razor, and he used to slice it so thin that it used to liquefy in the pan with just a little oil. It's a very good system. Vinny was in charge of the tomato sauce.
Ah, got the smoke. That treat, the kinds of meat in the meatballs.
What'd you put in
there? Veal, beef, and pork.
Ah, good, but you gotta have the pork. That's
the flavor.
I felt he used too many onions, but it was still a very good sauce.
Vinny, don't put too many onions in the sauce.
I didn't put too much onions, three small onions, that's all I did.
Three onions? How many cans of tomatoes you put in there?
I put two big cans.
You don't need three onions.
Johnny Dio did the meat. We didn't have a broiler, so Johnny did everything in pans. I used to smell up the joint something awful, and the hacks used to die, but he still cooked a great steak.
Vinny, how do you like George?
Medium rare.
An aristocrat.
I read something interesting in the November issue of GQ. It's about oysters, and it became this tradition in this guy's house to have oysters on Thanksgiving. And I should remind you that we're in months now that end in ER, and as long as the months end in ER, it's oyster season, and you should be eating a lot of oysters, preferably raw. But this article was pretty fantastic, and it really made me appreciate living a good life, because it's not hard, it's not expensive to live a really good life. Called it a shucking good time. He said Thanksgiving morning was typically a game of hurry up and wait, because you get, you know, you stuff the bird, you set the table, and then you're kind of just hanging on the couch. In your younger and less responsible years, you're sleeping off a hangover. But on 10 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day in 2005, this guy, the doorbell rang at his parents' place in Princeton. He pulls on his clothes, checks out who it is, and standing on the front porch was his father's friend. And in his arms were two dozen unshucked oysters and two bottles of champagne. The guy goes, "I brought breakfast." "You let me in." His mom was at his aunt's house getting dinner together for the, you know, for their meal, and so they sat there, and they were shucking oysters and drinking champagne. And he said it was the best Thanksgiving morning he'd ever had in his life, and it became a tradition. It, you know, I think this is one of life's simple pleasures. It really is a gift. Bourdain has said this in the past, that the oyster is like the gift from the food gods, because it's got its own sauce. It tastes like the sea. You know, a lot of people have a hard time with the texture of an oyster, and it's a whole texture thing, and I totally understand that. If you think it tastes like snot or feels like snot, you won't eat it. But, man, I'll tell you, you eat a really good oyster, and you can get past that texture thing. It's godlike. It really is. Now, the sauce, I'm not sure. Is it Mignonet or a Mignonette? It looks like Mignonet. Anyway, it's from Eric Repair at Le Bernardin in New York. And it's very easy. 1 cup of finely minced shallots, 1 cup of sherry vinegar, 1 cup of balsamic vinegar, and then 2 sprigs of fresh tarragon. You combine the shallots, the sherry vinegar, and the balsamic in a bowl. Then you add the tarragon, allow that to infuse for about a half an hour, and then just spoon it over freshly shucked oysters. It's a nice little sauce. I like a little horseradish sometimes. I like a little hot pepper sauce sometimes. Sometimes I don't like anything. Maybe a little sea salt, and then I'll just choke that sucker down. But man, I'm a sucker for champagne, too. Anyway, that should be a new tradition for everybody on Thanksgiving. Next Thanksgiving, make that your tradition. In the morning, you wake up. It's okay to drink on a holiday early. Doesn't matter. Hey, look, it's 10 o'clock somewhere. I mean, 12 o'clock or whatever. Who gives a shit? Look, act like you're James Bond. Just drink the champagne. Okay, time to piss off more Italian Americans, but I got to take a beer here. Hold on. All right, before I play this clip, I want to share something, because I was talking about my mother speaking Italian earlier, and I thought about this. When I was growing up, whenever my mom, my aunts, and uncles would get together, they'd all speak Italian to each other. They'd only speak in Italian, because when they were growing up, you know, my grandparents were immigrants, so they didn't speak a lot of English. In fact, their English was horrible, but they spoke a lot of Italian, so the kids grew up knowing Italian. So when they grew up, they would speak Italian to each other, and I don't know if it was because they didn't want the kids to know what they were talking about, or if that just made them feel more like they were still kids with their parents, and they spoke Italian in that house. So anyway, it was English all day at home. But the minute we had the Marsala convention, it was all Italian all the time. Even when I lived with my aunt and my mother together in high school, they'd be speaking Italian right in front of me at the dinner table. I didn't know if they were speaking about me, because in Italian, you don't know, but they'd say Felipe. Now, I knew Felipe in Italian, that means Philip, that's me. So the conversation would be like, Domi abbiamo due schede qua solo, Rufinito Felipe ci spenge lo fruore il fomento. And when I heard Felipe, I knew something was up. I'd say, hey, speak Italian or teach me Italian. But no, my mother would never teach me Italian because if she did, I'd know what they were saying. And I'm a kid. It was none of my business. And well, I respected that. So, of course, I tried to teach myself Italian, and that was a freaking debacle. Of course, all I ended up learning were the dirty words because they were the most fun anyway.
And the bosses were no better. I mean, they complained day and night because things don't run smooth. Well, in my line of work, things don't run so smooth. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm dealing with degenerate animals out here. But the bosses, what do they give a fuck? They're sitting on their asses drinking Anisette. Meanwhile, I'm the guy in the trenches.
Fucking bosses. I mean, they're smoking their denobles and they're eating our drip and fucking soufrite. You know, fried pig's guts. Well, if I want to talk private, I got to go to a fucking bus stop.
But hey, what do they care? As long as I keep sending money back.
All right, you guys have got to hear this. This is going to be a bit racy, all right? So if your kids are listening or if you're at work or something, maybe put some earphones on or zoom past this and listen later. I want you to tell me if this is from a best-selling book or from Penthouse Forum. And let's say we had a little porn music on top of it, too, to spice things up.
She put her arms around his neck and hung there as he opened his trousers. Then he placed both hands beneath her bare buttocks and lifted her. She gave a little hop in the air so that both her legs were wrapped around his upper thighs. His tongue was in her mouth, and she sucked on it. He gave a savage thrust that banged her head against the door. She felt something burning pass between her thighs. She let her right hand drop from his neck and reached down to guide him. Her hand closed around an enormous, blood-gorged pole of muscle. It pulsated in her hand like an animal. And almost weeping with grateful ecstasy, she pointed it into her own wet, turgid flesh. The thrust of its entering, the unbelievable pleasure made her gasp, brought her legs up almost around his neck, and then, like a quiver, her body received the savage arrows of his lightning-like thrusts, innumerable, torturing, arching her pelvis higher and higher until, for the first time in her life, she reached a shattering climax, felt his hardness break, and then the crawly flood over her thighs.
Wow. Oh, man. I'm sweating. This is actually audio from the audiobook version of The Godfather by Mario Puzo, which was published in 1969. But if I didn't tell you that, if I didn't tell you what that was, I wonder, would you think this is actually something from a smut rag or a nasty novella? I mean, holy crap. And listen, I cleaned that up. I read this segment in the book, and I was like waiting for Puzo to start writing about, you know, all the bukkake Sonny'd been known for around these parts or something. It's just amazing. I read that, and I'm like, oh, man, the audiobook has got to be 10 times more entertaining than this. So you're welcome.
Hey, Mikey, why don't you tell that nice girl you love her? I love you with all of my heart. If I don't see you again soon, I'm going to die. Hey, come over here, kid. Learn something. You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, some tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar, and that's my trick.
Why don't you cut the crap? I got more important things for you to do. How's Paulie?
Oh, Paulie. Won't see him no more.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
Jared Wentworth is the head chef at Longman and Eagle in Chicago, and he recently offered some suggestions on how to pair whiskey with food, and it does actually make sense to those who have tried it. But when you're thinking about it, whiskey, being made from corn or barley, rye, grains, that you'd normally make beer from, it kind of makes sense. So here's what Chef Wentworth suggests. He says, if you're going to have savory sweet food, you want to use a sweet whiskey. So you dry out the sauces and glazes with a sweet whiskey like Black Maple Hill. The savory elements will kind of sing against the sweet whiskey. Now, if you're having earthy food, you want an earthy whiskey. If the food is woodsy or smoky, you know, the whiskey should be woodsy or smoky, like Lafroig. You know, that's a nice scotch that's got a peaty flavor to it. Kind of like, I kind of say it's like Band-Aids, but it's really smoky. Peaty, Heritage Reserve, Lafroig, 16-year-old, it's a great match for something like braised short ribs. You know, something nice and earthy and smoky. Now, if you're doing like dessert, well, you know, with chocolate or something like that, bourbon works better than port. You would automatically think to go to some sweet wine, like Muscat or something, or maybe even a barley wine. But no, you see, bourbon is the way to go. So it's kind of interesting. I like going in those avenues and seeing what we can do with spirits, especially with cocktails. I remember on Top Chef, they had to pair certain cocktails with dishes, and that looked pretty challenging. So how are you doing on those mob clips? Has anything stumped you yet? I don't know why Italian-Americans got pissed off about this. I mean, they should be honored. I mean, look, the Italians are not the only group of people, with a history of crime syndicates. You got the Russian mob, you got the Irish mob, the Chinese mob, the Mexican mob. 2 hours south of me, we got the Mexican mob. There's all kinds of crime syndicates and every type of people. But the Italian-Sicilian mafia is popular because it's got style. I will say this, though. I mean, they have glamorized it in Hollywood. I recently saw Gomorra, which is based on a true situation going on right now in Naples. And it's far from glamorous. I mean, that's what the mafia really looks like. If you want to know, it's not The Sopranos, it's not The Godfather, it's not Goodfellas. It's not pinstripe suits, cigars, strippers, card games, big lavish meals, fun. No, it's living in squalor, selling drugs to 9-year-old kids, laying on a dirty floor, wearing nothing but your underwear and a pair of soggy sneakers, getting a 9mm slug ripped through your skull. That's the mafia. That's what the mafia is. It's not anything that should be glamorized or celebrated. Now, I was pissed. At the end of Godfather 3, Michael Corleone was a prick. He deserved to be clipped. Instead, he dies of old age. He got off light. That's bullshit. That's what happens. Some of these guys die in prison of cancer or old age. And they should be clipped. Because they're horrible people. They kill people. They extort money out of people. You know, that's, I wouldn't celebrate that. Although I'm celebrating it. Not really. I'm making fun of it. All right, look. I know we're doing a lot of audio here, but we always do anyway, so you just deal with it. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of this or not, although I know we talked about it when the show was announced. I talked about it with Don. I had Don on the show. Brewmasters with fellow Paisan Sam Caglione started last Sunday on the Discovery Channel, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's not just a great show that showcases craft beer and the brilliance of an artist like Sam, but it's a great show, period, not because it's about beer. It's like he's given a Top Chef-style recipe to come up with every week, and it shows him racing to develop the recipe with his staff and get it under a certain timeline. He's got to get it to market. He's got a really tight deadline. It's smart. It's funny. Sam is charismatic. He's perfect for television. And like I said, it's not just a great show about beer. It might be one of the best food and drink shows on television, period.
Adam at Sony Records emailed me out of the blue and was like, would you be interested in doing this little project where you got the 40th anniversary of Bitches Brew coming out and we want to do a liquid Bitches Brew beer?
Miles Davis was a popular jazz trumpet player throughout the 60s. But with the release of Bitches Brew in 1970, Miles pushed the boundaries of music by fusing jazz and rock.
I've been listening to Miles for the vast majority of my life, and so to get the call from Sony to say, hey, let's try and do this together, was a huge moment for me personally.
But there's also a lot of pressure, because Bitches Brew is going to be a high-profile, nationally distributed beer. Our company is going to invest a lot of time and money into this new beer. Unlike wine, where you're relying on natural elements like the weather, the land, and the grapes to ensure a good wine, beer is much more of a human craft with a greater margin for error.
Imagine being at a restaurant and you get a crappy pint of beer and you say, hey, bartender, this beer is kind of crappy. And the bartender being like, oh, yeah, that was a bad year for this beer. That doesn't happen in the beer world. We can't blame the vintage of barley that we got.
It's really up to us to get this Bitches Brew right.
Challenging news is the timeline that we have to do this on to hit the targeted release date is half what we normally have to take this beer from the concept phase through production, meaning design packaging, come up with a recipe to begin with, and then do a test batch. So this is going to be interesting because we get one shot at this. So we better not screw this up. This beer is going to have a lot of different stuff in it, but Tej is going to be one of the anchors for it. So I was hoping to seek unfiltered honey that still had like chunks of bees in it.
Wow.
And then also either getting the geisha root as a crushed root, almost like a powder, or getting it by the leaves.
Maybe could we get you started to test with one of our Tej?
Next thing you know, we're enjoying beverages. I like it.
Samuel and his crew hooked me up with some great authentic ingredients to share with my guys so we can come up with a recipe for this beer.
Basically, the part that I'm good at is in my hands, and now I gotta give this to Floris and Brian and turn this into a true test recipe, so hope it goes well.
I'm here to meet Floris, our brewmaster, and Brian, our lead brewer. They don't know this yet, but I've decided to unveil Bitches Brew at one of the premier craft beer and food events called Savor in just 5 weeks. Because Bitches Brew is not even a beer yet, we have to nail down a recipe, like today.
That kind of looks like that beer, doesn't it? It's not that, actually. It's Tej, which is Ethiopian national drink. So there's no barley in that, no hops in that. It's just geisha root for bitterness and 100% fermented from honey. What do you think of that?
It's a neat aroma. It's a neat flavor. I think I'd kind of like to take this to the brewery, into the lab, and make like a tea of it.
And do we want to use leaves or do we want to use sticks? Because like sticks is your favorite band, but that
it
might
sure
not
is.
Be the best.
Domo arigato.
What I'm thinking for this Bitches Brew beer is this full-on traditional Ethiopian Tej being a component of the final brew.
It's very winey, too.
Yeah. But what I'm thinking is, to make it more beer-like, do a really gigantic, dark, dark stout.
Tej is not your everyday session drink. It's sweet, like cloyingly sweet, and has a boatload of alcohol, closer to wine than beer. On the other hand, an Imperial Stout is sort of a dry, roasty, chocolatey beer with much less alcohol.
When we combine a Tej and a Stout,
yeah.
we have very different beers.
Isn't that but great?
That is great, but we also, what do we want to have from each?
We want the geisha, earthy aroma.
The earthiness I found quite good.
And I think we want some of the complexity coming from honey.
What Floris is worried about is the fact that to make a beer with a high alcohol content, you need time. A typical ale with 5% alcohol by volume, or ABV, takes around 2 weeks from brewing to bottling. We want Bitches Brew to end up around 9%, which will take at least 3 to 4 weeks. The first step of brewing a beer is mashing in. That's where we mix water and malted barley.
This tank's basically like a giant colander. So it's got a perforated hole. We'll mix the hot water and the barley, basically make like hot porridge in here.
We have a very specific temperature that we want to reach with our mash that totally dictates which enzymes will do the conversion of starches into sugar.
Which the yeast will eat and convert into alcohol.
Correct.
After mashing in, we separate the liquids from the solids and are left with wort, or young beer. We send this young beer to the boil kettle, where we add our specialty ingredients.
So now, once your liquid's in the boil kettle, that's when you add your spices. Every brewery at least adds hops, because that's mandated by law. Fortunately or unfortunately, water, yeast, hops, and barley have to go into beer. Since hops don't grow in Africa, the local honey beer is bittered with geisha root. We are going to do a little hybrid today and use both crushed geisha leaf and a couple of these tea bags full of the organic geisha sticks.
We add the hydrated geisha leaves and the geisha stick tea bags and let that steep for about 15 minutes. After the boil, the wort then gets sent to the fermenter. We cool the young beer, add oxygen and yeast, and let it ferment for 2 to 4 weeks. The Imperial Stout portion is going to be 3/4 of the Bitches Brew, and the Tej Brew will make up the remaining quarter. The stout will have a variety of specialty grains, including roasted barley, amber malt, and crystal malt. We'll also add some dark sugar from Africa. The Tej will be made with barley and raw honey, as well as the sticks and leaves from the geisha plant. We'll blend these two types of beer pre-bottling to make our Bitches Brew. In total, we're doing about 12,000 gallons of beer today. We'll send the Tej to one fermenter, and all 3 batches of stout will be in another. After a few weeks, we'll blend these together just before we bottle to create our Bitches Brew.
Now we wait. It takes about a month, you know, from when you brew a beer to when you're packaging a beer. But so far, so good.
Tonight is really a night to celebrate with Vince, Miles' nephew, and Adam from Sony.
Cheers.
This is the man.
We're celebrating the man over there is what we're celebrating.
I mean, the music speaks for itself.
Yeah.
You know, and this is just icing on the cake.
Beer is delicious. Every time I taste it, I'm surprised at how easy it is to drink.
I think my Uncle Miles would have been proud. I think he would be proud of this moment.
I'm really, really psyched with the way this project with Sony has turned out. The beer's been a huge success, and I'm hoping that Adam and I can work together again. Sony Records has an amazing stable of artists, and to do a beer with any of them would be awesome.
Brewmasters, every Sunday on Discovery Channel, check your local listings, and they do repeat these shows, okay? So if you missed the first episode, or you missed the Sunday's episode, you can definitely still see it. The second show is on this Sunday. If you love beer, watch this show. If you make homebrew, definitely watch this show.
Hey, can I ask you something?
What?
What's forget about it? What is that?
Forget about it. It's like, if you agree with someone, you know, like Raquel Welch is one great piece of ass, forget about it. But then, if you disagree, like a Lincoln is better than a Cadillac, forget about it. You know? But then, it's also like if something is the greatest thing in the world, like Mingo's peppers, forget about it, you know? But it's also like saying go to hell, too. Like, you know, like, hey, Bully, you got a one-inch pecker, and Bully says, forget about it.
Forget about it.
Bully, forget about it.
Sometimes it just means forget about it.
All right. Thank you very much. I got it.
Let me tell you something. I don't get this bow for Lefty. What?
Forget about it?
Fucking forget about it.
You think I cook like them Goombas in Brooklyn? All they know is Maragot, Maragot. 100 years, they're going to be Maragot.
You never ate Coco Van, huh?
No.
Yeah. Here we go. Can of collagen. Can of tomatoes. Punch of salt.
Punch?
Punch. Punch of salt.
Punch or pinch?
Punch, punch. Not pinch. What did I say? I said pinch?
No, you said punch.
Sometimes you don't make no fucking sense, buddy. All
right. You gotta listen in.
Oh, no. I can't cook special like Benny.
Shut up on that. Forget about it. Wherever you go, the best cooks are men. On Mars, the best cooks are gonna be men. That's a fact. All done. Wait till you taste this cocoa, man. It'll melt in your mouth. Like Holy Communion. What the fuck is that? Annette, get that.
Right, you guys know the name Alan Richman now, right? Alan Richman was the guy that Anthony Bourdain called the C-word. He writes for GQ and the New York Times. Well, he did an expose on Eataly, which is Mario Batali's new food court. And I knew about this because Charles Thompson from 100 Miles, my friend Charles, he blogged about this when it first opened. A high-end Italian food court in New York. I mean, they say it makes Whole Foods look like a 7-Eleven. He said, you might have seen the snapshots, a blissful couple striding into Eataly, nervously triumphant, awash in applause, blinking as dozens of cameras flashed. That was me with my pal Sandra Rose, the very first people to enter the ultimate mega foodie paradise in New York history. Not to exaggerate, I felt like a new model of sports car cheered as it came off the assembly line. They got into this place. They have fresh pasta, fresh cheeses, they've got everything. It's like going into Whole Foods. They've got chefs in there cooking food. They've got a butcher. Everything you could possibly imagine. Redefining Italian food. And he says the food is fantastic. You've got chefs cooking food. You've got sommeliers. You've got fresh produce, fresh meat, pizzas, a pizzeria, a cheese shop, desserts. You name it. It's like going into the Disneyland of Italian food. So they have a flagship store in Turin. It opened in 2007. And those who have been to both of these stores, you know, kind of say that Turin's a calmer, more serene place. The Fifth Avenue store in New York is stuffed with overanxious New York, you know, shoppers. People from New York are a lot more frenetic. But he told me restaurant sales in Turin account for only 28% of business, in part because Italians dine at set times, lunch and dinner. In New York, they eat all the time. In the first few days, the restaurants had to close. You know, for a variety of reasons. such as not enough food, or their staff was like all exhausted, or they had computer problems. They had desperate customers that were grabbing takeout items intended for purchase at the exit line, unwrapping them at deserted restaurant tables, ate them right there. Joe Bastianich, you know who Joe Bastianich is? He's his partner in this deal. The guy's a restaurateur. Man, when he was on MasterChef with Gordon Ramsay, I did not like him. So I kind of take, I don't know, it's kind of hard for me to think positively about this guy, although he's a good dude. Well, he was nasty to those people. Then again, they're on a, you know, MasterChef. What are you going to do? They're putting their soul on the line. They've got 5 Eataly's in Italy, 4 in Japan. Italians, unfortunately, do not love rules. That's what he says. American people stay in line. Italians don't stay in line. When they want to sit, American people ask the hostess for permission and they wait. The Italian people see an empty table, they sit down. In Italy, when Italians order pizza and pasta, if the pizza comes and then the pasta comes 5 minutes later, it's not a problem. In America, the people think the whole thing must come at the same time. But the people who are most different are the Japanese. The Japanese do not steal anything, so you don't need any control. For stealing, the Japanese are 0 out of 10. The Americans are 2 or 3. The Italians are 7 or an 8. Hey, nothing for nothing. But the Italians, come on. 8 out of 10 people are going to steal? Forget about it. He said the Italy people have taken no chances. The place is stuffed with celebrity chefs whose endorsements Americans wholeheartedly embrace. The Italy hierarchy, best I can tell, has Farinelli on top, Batali and the 2 Bastianiches as top lieutenants, and a cadre of other famous chefs standing behind their specialties. Nancy Silverton does bread there. He says what's difficult to figure is how long Italy will command the attention of New Yorkers. They expect lines for 2 more years. Alan Richman suspects it'll be longer than that. Turin has a population of 1 million. The Italy over there attracts 2.5 million visitors a year. New York has 8 million residents. That can add up to 20 million customers a year. Unbelievable. And they think after all this, Italy just might not be big enough. They said the place was Whole Foods, that, you know, times 12, and that's not big enough? I'll tell you what. If you're an Italian and you're not living in New York, you're in the wrong place. Okay, listen up because this is important. Eat My Blog is happening again next Saturday, December 4th at Tender Greens in West Hollywood. I participated in this with Jo from My Last Bite earlier this year. She used my bacon in her bacon-wrapped breadsticks recipe. Big hit. This time I'm actually baking, all right? So I've got a kick-ass coconut cranberry cookie to share with you guys. So if you're in L.A. or the O.C. area, you have time. It would mean the world to me and the rest of my fellow food bloggers in the L.A. and O.C. area if you came by next Saturday, December 4th, and purchased a few of our baked goods to help us raise money for the L.A. Regional Food Bank. We're giving 100% of all the money we raise for the sale to the food bank. So all of our time, all of our efforts, our ingredients, everything that we do is going towards curing hunger in Los Angeles. So, that said, if you're a cold-hearted bastard who doesn't care that there are people out there in this holiday season who are hungry and might not get a meal today, don't show up next Saturday, December 4th at 8759 Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. However, if you do care about people and you do have a heart and you're not really the Grinch, I'll see you there and I'll introduce you to the nicest group of people you're ever going to meet in your life. These girls are friendly, they're talented, they know how to bake, and I'm telling you, this is no ordinary bake sale. And to prove it, last time we had the bake sale, someone came by and they go, you know what, this is no ordinary bake sale. So take that. We had items there last time that I swear you'd see in a counter from a high-end bakery. There's some talent out here, and I'm not just saying it because they're cute and they're my friends. I'm saying it because it's true, and we're trying to do our part to help those less fortunate than we are. They raised over $8,000 between the past 2 events, and we want to blow the lid off the place this time. So don't suck. Don't disappoint me. Don't be the disappointment of my life. Come taste my cookie, everybody. Wait a minute. Eatmybloglawordpress.com. I'll see you guys on Saturday.
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in. Our true enemy has not yet shown his face.
Michael.
Yes.
Now they'll fear you.
Maybe they should fear you.
Okay, listen up. That's all I've got for you guys this time. There's so much more I want to share. There's so much more I'm going to share. We've got at least 2 more shows in December. So get ready for a lot more of My Life as a Foodie to end the year. And really, we're only getting started. I've got a lot I want to do and a plan of getting it all in. Top Chef All Stars starts this Wednesday, debuts December 1st. Bourdain is a judge, and it might be the best season of Top Chef ever, maybe the last. We'll cover it all on the next episode, so tune in then. Music in this episode from Saliva. If you like the song, you can buy it from their website, saliva.com, or from the iTunes store. Check mylifeasafoodie.com for the details, and you can buy the song, support the band. Thanks for tuning in, thanks for playing along, and for being patient while I finish Dude Food. My name is Phil, this has been My Life as a Foodie, and I'll see all you Goombas next time. Ciao.
I want that son of a bitch dead. I want him dead. I want him dead. I don't care.
What am I, alone in this world? Did I ask you what you're trying to do?
I want you to get this fuck where he breathes. I want you to find this Nancy boy, Elliot Ness. I want him dead. I want his family dead. I want his house burnt to the ground. I want to go to the middle of the night. I want to piss on his ashes.
Come on, Mr. Capone. You want to fight? You want to fight you and me right here? That's it. Come on. Somebody, you afraid to come out from behind your men? You afraid to stand up for yourself?
You want to do it now? You want to go to mine now?
Come on, you son of a bitch.
What?
Easy.
You talk to me like that in front of my son? Fuck you and your family.
You know, fuck, you got nothing.
There's not a lot of talking to bad. You're here because you got nothing. You got nothing in court. You don't got the bookkeeper. You got nothing. And if you were a man, you would have done it now. You don't got a thing, you punk.